Tamam. Zaten çok yeterli. Finansal sanatçılar kanun tanımı kullanıyor. Çünkü sanat da lazım. Böyle We feel very elated, actually, because it was Suzuki Roshi who brought Koban Kino Akabara here. And for those of you who are in South Limburg, I explained that Suzuki Roshi brought Koban here from Japan instead of Katsuhara, instead of the forms in practice. So we are deeply indebted and related to this lineage. Nisha received a translation from Suzuki Roshi's disciple, Wosuke, in 1998. And since 1993, she has been the guiding teacher of Zen Park Sangha on the peninsula. She lives nearby in the hills above Stanford with her husband and four Flickering friends, and joyfully cultivates a large garden. We're very happy to welcome her. Back to the and I hope you will listen and behold. So good morning, everyone, or almost good afternoon. Good morning to those of you who are joining online. Thank you. As Anton-san said, my association with the Jacobi, the very first time that I came here was in, I believe, 1987. The Zendo looked quite different, not nearly as nice as it does now. And every time you moved, the whole building moved with you. It was a very odd feeling because of the stilt structure. But I sat back in that corner, and Koban Kino was sitting here giving a lecture. And he had a fairly strong accent of English. And I had been deputized by my teacher, Les, to come and ask for Koban Kino's help for his Dharma transmission. And I was a brand new monk. My hair at that point was just long. It was winter. And snowing. And I had never met Koban Kino-san face to face. And I would say I was back in that corner, and there was where the altar is now, there was the wood stove was there in the center of the room. And they had it going. And so it was really warm. I was sitting in Koban Kino's room. And the next thing I knew, I was sort of drifting off, and suddenly I heard, "Whoa, and you recently ordained." On the spot. We had a wonderful talk afterwards, but it was my first realization that you best not drift off during someone's Dharma talk, no matter whether you understand it or not. So there's just so many things that we could be talking about today. But I imagine that many of you are having the same difficulty as I and many of my students are having, which is we are living in a very chaotic time. That is a time of great loss, a time of uncertainty. It's a time of instability, where we don't seem to be able to cross over our disagreements to having actual conversation. So last summer, I was very fortunate to be able to attend a conference that was in Santa Cruz. The Suzuki Roshi lineages, there are many small groups like mine. And so we are part of what's called the branching stream. They go out from San Francisco. And this was a branching stream conference. And there were many, many people there, all representing, I think, about 50 small groups. And we had some incredible conversations. It was a bit of an open agenda. We made a giant chart on the wall, and people just started going up and writing things that they would like to have discussions about. And then, you know, we had like rooms on one end and conversations on the other, and you put them together, and then you got to choose where you wanted to go. So very rich and varied. But then on the penultimate evening, they invited the speaker who was the word that was going on, and I had a feeling. The poet laureate from Santa Cruz, but she was not at that point, but she had been for many years. And they had asked her to come and share her poetry, which was amazing. But then at the end, she surprised us. Here I'm thinking she's just going to read a lot of the poetry, and we're going to have a chance to ask you questions. And instead, she says, "So I'm really interested in what you're doing here. I'm not a Buddhist per se, but I really like a lot of the ideas that you're thinking about. So I'm going to give you a card. And we're going to divide up into groups in this room, which was probably about the size of this one. And all about 8 to 10. And what you are going to talk about is practicing loss. I was struck immediately by this, partly because I always thought that what I was practicing was acceptance. But in the moment that she said that, I thought, well, of course, we don't have to practice acceptance about all the good things that are happening to us. We think those are, you know, part of the deal, that we are worthy and deserve them. But when bad things or difficult things happen, there's always this part of us that goes, why me? And so actually what we're always doing in practicing acceptance is we are practicing loss. So one of the reasons that I'm going to be taking my glasses on and off is that over the last 3 months, I have had two eye surgeries for glaucoma. I'm not even 70 years old, and I have glaucoma. So already, there's some loss there. The first eye surgery went very well. And within 10 days, I could see perfectly again. It was amazing. So there's the other part of it, is our expectations. The second eye surgery, which was at the end of February, I assumed it would all happen the same way. And it didn't. As my surgeon said, every single eye, even in the same person, is different. And so you will notice when we meet later that this eye is halfway open and I still halfway can't see. So I'm using glasses so that my left eye can help me read my notes. So they'll be coming on and off because this eye gets really weird about my glasses. So it's ridiculous. Right? So we're practicing loss. We're practicing on a global scale, which includes things like the current conflict in the Middle East and the war in Ukraine, which is an Afghanistan, and all of the starvation that is happening in Gaza, which breaks my heart because of, I'm afraid, the old and the babies. We are suffering in this country because it appears that even democracy is now up for grabs. Something that we have all so taken for granted all our lives is now in question. Things that women took for granted. The year I turned 18 was when Roe versus Wade came out. And here we are, all of a sudden, without control over our own bodies. So, everything seems to be up for grabs, but the truth is, everything always comes to me. And if you are a student of history, you know that ancient Rome was no better than what we're doing right now. People like Nero and Caligula, well, we got nothing on those guys. So there's global loss, there's national loss, and then, of course, for all of it, there's personal loss. I can't really complain about what has happened with me. I know that my eyesight will eventually return, which is going to take a little longer than I expected. And so I'm very fortunate to have my personal chauffeur, my friend Lydia, who brings me all over the place so I can do things like this because I can't drive. Which is a huge loss to not be able to drive. We feel what happens to you. But, you know, I have one very dear family member who has pancreatic cancer. She has been going through chemotherapy for 2.5 years, and she still writes and says, it's going okay. I have another friend who had an ulcerous cancerous lesion on her eyelid, and now her eye, this one eye, has had to be sewn shut for 3 months. It's like, okay, you mean I have the altar in my home is where my group meets on Saturday. It has so many little moon parts on it, there's almost no room. So many people suffering after a stroke. Individuals who have died during COVID. I'm sure many of you knew people who died. And maybe they didn't die of COVID. I lost my mother during COVID. She died of old age. But it was very hard at the end when she was in a facility and they did not want to let my brother in, and he was the one that lived near her. And he absolutely, he just didn't find a way to take her out. And so they finally did let him be there with her while she was dying. There are so many stories, though, that we've heard of people who ended up in the hospital. And the only people that had the cure were the nurses and the doctors. And it's been very interesting to me, having gone through these two latest surgeries, to talk to all the nurses. The second post-op nurse had actually retired. She was older than me. And they had asked that she would come back because they are so low on nursing. Everybody got burned out during COVID. We are all still in a state of exhaustion from this. So there's another loss. A loss of the people that we depend upon for our well-being. So, when it was time for my group to meet to talk about practicing loss, I had a group of about 10 people, and we were in one corner of the room, and then all the other groups, I think there were 4 or 5, were around, so it was kind of noisy, except in my group. All the other groups were laughing and talking and shouting over each other, and there were some sad stories that you could hear, but my group, not one person was speaking. And there was this part of me that thought, oh dear, do I have to be the first one to speak again? Because I was trying to hold myself back. But nobody was speaking. And finally I thought, okay, I'll have to start the conversation. And I did, in much the same way I just did. About the difference between practicing acceptance and practicing loss. And I was talking about my own sin. And it was so wonderful. Because they had stayed quiet and self-reflected for so long, when they did finally speak, it was honest and authentic and moving and devastating the things that people were going through. It came up yesterday in our silent discussion in the morning of someone who had been having great difficulty with another individual. And then heard that this individual's wife was currently in the hospital and that someone that he had been caregiving for was dying. And it put everything in perspective for him. Yes, this person is a bit of a curmudgeon, but there's a lot going on in his life, and my response could be more compassionate. Which, you know, there's the old saying, be kind and careful because you do not know what battles an individual is going through. So I am often reminded of the five recollections from Thich Nhat Hanh. I actually had them calligraphy years and years ago by my friend Inga, and my home in the guest bathroom, which is where my Sangha, and one of my Sangha uses. Because I think it's worthwhile every now and then while you're walking your hands to see this thing on the wall. For those of you who aren't familiar, this is how it goes. I am of the nature to grow old. There is no way to escape growing old. Unless, of course, you're growing young. You don't like it. I am of the nature to have ill health. There is no way to escape having ill health. I am of the nature to die. There is no way to escape. All that is dear to me and everyone I love are of the nature to change. There is no way to escape being separated from me. My actions are my only true belongings. I cannot escape the consequences of my actions. My actions are the ground on which I sit. Yesterday we were reading something about Robert Hilton, and he was talking about the ground of Zen. And I brought that up as the topic of discussion. What do you think is the ground of Zen? Right here, right now, with my movement in Zen, with all of you. That is it. This moment right here, this is actually all we've got. Period. End of story. You could go home today and there could be a terrible earthquake, or I could get into a car crash. Or one of us could have a stroke. So, you know, ad infinitum, the list goes on. There is nothing that you can escape. That is the ground of Zen. The ground of Zen. The only thing that you have any control over at all are your actions. You can't control anyone else. One day I was up talking to my teacher friend partner at San Francisco Zen, and I was complaining about a student and this and that, and finally she stopped me and she said, "Isa, it sounds like you're trying to fix her." And I looked at her and said, "Yes, you're right, it does sound that way." She said, "Don't you know you can't fix anyone? You can hardly fix yourself." He's like, "Well, that's true." It was a wonderful reminder. We're so busy trying to tell everybody else how to do their job, how to do it better. We offer our opinion on every possible subject, even when we don't know anything. But we can't do anything about this person right here, which is actually the only one you have any real chance of doing anything about. Because I don't know if you have noticed it, but it is so much easier to blame out there, to blame the weather, to blame your spouse or partner, to blame your job. It's so much easier to offer blame than it is to look squarely at the self and say, how could I do something particular? The sort of moment of epiphany for me happened many years ago. I may have shared this last time with some of you about tea. I'll be teaching on them. I had a friend who was a member of the Kondo Sangha, where I left with the teacher. And that was where I grew up as a Zen student. But she was also a member of my tea group with my tea teacher. This was a person who, from week to week, could not remember anything. And she'd come in and it'd be like starting the lesson all over again for her. And I never once saw my tea teacher act impatient or exasperated. Judging her, she would just say, all right, you need it. Move the ball to your right. Move the last one. You could go through it step by step for this person. And I at first wondered about it, but as a teacher myself later, I realized this person had severe learning difficulties. But at the time, I didn't understand that. But she was also a member of my Zen community. And in those days, it was the old place that Kanada used to be. And there was a big, wooden sliding door, and it was not standard. It had been made. And so you learned how to open it very slowly, because otherwise it made this roar sound. And then, because of the fact that this had been a Baptist church, and there had been a baptismal font, they had had to raise the floor inside the room about that much, so that there was a small step down into the center. Every time this person arrived, the door went roar. And then he'd step into the room and forget the stair was there. Every single time. And I would be sitting there facing the wall in the garden and just like, oh, can't she remember? No. And she was overweight, so it didn't help because then when she missed the steps, it was a lot of weight falling onto the floor. But at some point, there was this part of me that said, he's not going to change. He has learning differences, like your kids at school. You would never be this hard on them. You wouldn't judge them for it. You would be trying to help them. So if she can't change, what's the other alternative here? You can change. And so came the next Saturday, and through the floor, this person walked with the door and closed with the door. But I started smiling to myself and said, good morning. In my head. And from that day on, it never bothered me anymore. When we realize that we're stuck in a place, either when we're judging someone or we're upset with them, and they keep behaving the same way and making us crazy, we have to get out of the rut of blame. We have to get out of the rock of judgment. We need to get to the place of understanding that we cannot escape the consequences of our actions. The actions in our life are the ground under the skin. If you look at these recollections from a Buddhist perspective, from the Buddha, They are basically the Four Noble Truths. So the first three recollections about old age, sickness, and death, that's what the first truth was about. There will be suffering. Suffering is the first noble truth. There will also be joy and delight and heartache and sadness and loss. There's going to be everything. But you can be sure there will be something. And you need to understand why. Why does there have to be something? Why does there have to be old age and sickness and death? Because we have a body. Hearing something. I was recently watching something about the Black Plague. We think that COVID was bad. The population of England was halved during the Black Plague. They didn't have a place to bury the bodies. They just dug giant holes and threw the bodies in. The fourth recollection of there's no way to escape, but that my actions are my true belongings. That's where I can do something. That's his understanding. That no matter how wonderful his life was, pain and loss are inevitable. How many people here have lost their parents? At least one. Oh, please enjoy them. My dad died early at 73. Which everyone kept saying to me, what a terrible thing, he died so young. But 2 weeks earlier, one of my 15-year-old students said that. Puts everything in perspective. 73 seemed like a nice long time. But my mother lived until she was 93 and only died in 2020. But after 5 years of being paralyzed. You are not getting out alive. We will have these things happen. But he understood the true nature of reality, things as it is. And because of that, incident became very precious, very authentic. When he sat under the Bodhi tree and had the great understanding, it was this. Yes, all these things are true. And tomorrow, maybe I'll die. But right now, I have something. I am alive. I am here. I can breathe. I can think. I can be helpful. I don't know, did any of you read the story this last week about a man who had polio as a child and was put in an iron lung and he's lived there his entire life? And yet, he ended up studying and getting a law degree and helping other people while being in that iron lung. This is astonishing. You would rather sit around and feel sorry for oneself. These sufferings. So finally, though, the fifth recollection. My actions are my only true belongings. This is about emptiness. If you're new, you're going to think, what is that? What is she talking about? Emptiness, that's a weird word. It is a weird word. I guarantee it is a weird word. All it means in this case, empty of a permanent or abiding state. Everything is linked with that. And if you're curious, Thich Nhat Hanh has a wonderful book about the heart secret. It was the very first thing that made it completely clear to me. He was talking about a glass of water, and he was saying, there's the glass of, when you pour out all the water, is it empty? No, because now it's filled with air. Right? So he says, If something is empty, it has to be empty of something. So in this case, it's empty of water. Right? But in our case, what we're talking about is empty of a permanent, abiding nature. None of you is exactly the same as when you walk in the sun for many reasons. Your body has been doing all kinds of things while you've been sitting here. Your mind has been thinking all kinds of thoughts. You are suddenly with a group of people that you don't know or that you only know some. And there's an energy around them. And when you leave, maybe one or two words that I say today will stick with you. And that is going to be true. And maybe by looking around at all your faces, I am going just by looking at you. All of our senses are in play, and everything in every single second is changing. We're just not always aware of it. So, the only thing that we can actually point to as ours are our actions. This brings up the other Buddhist idea of karma. There are consequences to our actions. Mostly, we are unaware of those things. For instance, this morning, Lydia and I were driving here. There are bicyclists on the road. There are groups of cars that do, you know, just like the same car everybody has, and they do these little things together. So in one instance, there was a bicyclist who insisted on driving to the middle of the road. And then there were a couple of Porsches that zoomed by us on the left. Because everyone needs to be ready to go wherever they're going. Never thinking that around that next bend, one of the members of my Sangha lived next door to the couple that were driving with their best friends in the back seat from Wahanda to Pescadero that go out to dinner 2 months ago. And there was a driver on the other side coming the other way from the ocean, from Australia, where they drive on the other side of the road. And there was a place where there was a light and a one lane because of previous damage to the road last winter. And the Australian driver went on the one lane, and then he forgot. And he went back into the left lane instead of staying in the right lane. And when my Sangha members' friends came around the blind curve, he hit them with that one. The couple in the front that were driving were in serious condition, but they lived. But the couple, their best friends in the back seat, died instantly. Who could know? You can understand how it happened. If you're used to driving on the other side of the road, yes, he was a sports car driver. He was a professional racer. And he was going too fast. But even if he'd been going slower, it's not clear what would have happened. Maybe he could have gotten over that. Maybe not. There are consequences. There are consequences that are so small, like when you go to the grocery store, when you smile at the clerk, when you ask them sincerely how they're doing things. It means they'll go a little tiny bit better maybe after that. Or you stop along the way and realize somebody is looking lost, which happens in my neighborhood all the time. And you stop and ask if they need assistance. There's so many small things that we can do. And I always remember the very famous author, Aldous Huxley. At the end of his life, he was interviewed. I mean, Aldous Huxley wrote so many books about spirituality and about Darwin and spirituality and opening the doors of perception and things like that. And he's very famous, very famous family. And he has written off slides. And the interviewer said, so after all of these years and you know, you're old now, what's the most important thing that you do now? And he kind of smiled, apparently, and he was a little sheepish, and he said, well, it seems kind of silly, but I think if we could all just be a little kinder to each other. Not sweet or sentimental. Sometimes you have to be strong and you have to say the truth. But you can say it as kindly as possible. What I have noticed since COVID is that we have gotten increasingly aggressive. We drive aggressively, we speak aggressively. We're more willing to get in to fight. I mean, look at what happened on the planes after COVID, and people started beating up and cleaning up each other on the plane. That they had to have marshals be on the plane to protect us from each other. This is nice. But right now, this is our karma. It's our national karma. I mean, it's the international karma. But we need to turn to them. And when I say we, I'm really talking about us. It isn't somebody else's job to do this. It's our job, each of us. Students of the Buddha. And it's our job to take our peace into the world. However we do. Don't make the mistake of thinking you have to do something big. You don't have to go out and be Mother Teresa, or Gandhi, or Martin Luther King. You don't have to be any of these people. You don't have to be famous. You don't have to be known. You just have to be. Along with your partners. Everything is going to be taken away from you. Well, I'm sorry to say this too, because I see how many of you are young, but I'm almost 70. I didn't think this when I was in my 40s or even in my 30s. Your body is great, everything is wonderful. My body is great. I just can't see. That was a surprise. The rest of me is doing just fine. You don't know what's going to happen to you. I mean, I have been a vegetarian, most of my life. I exercise all the time. I'm strong. I live 20 minutes away, just like you told me. You know, we stack wood. We move it in to put it to the wood stove. We use the wood splitter. I mean, we're out there and we're not just gardening. Right? We're doing real physical labor. I have done this my whole life. I'm in great shape for someone who's about to turn 69. Genetics, on the other hand, my father had glaucoma. I'm the only sibling at first. Now my younger brother has it. Oh no! Some of you have something in your families. I have a heart attack on my father's side and a stroke on my mother's. What am I going to die of? I don't know. I could die on the way home in the car crash. You just don't know. This moment right here. This is it. And it is so hard to keep remembering that. We just get so caught up and busy with what we're doing in our lives. We get distracted from the reality of what is. This is what the Buddha understood. He didn't ask you to believe in anything. In fact, at the end of his life, he said, you know what? Just forget everything I've said. Don't write it down. Don't pass it on. Please don't make statues of me. Did we listen? No, we did not. What he said was, and this is what actually brought me to Zen practice, to Buddhism. He said, be a light unto yourself Shine that light inside. Look at yourself carefully. Be self-reflective. Watch yourself. Observe your thoughts. If you see negativity arising, be aware of that. If you want, pick up on this to talk about, we all have these seeds inside of us. And you have a choice. You do. This is where you get to have choice. You can water the seeds of negativity. And then you can grow up to be a curmudgeon. You can grow up to be mean-spirited. You can call people silly names and make fun of them and mock them. Or you can water the seeds of goodness and kindness and peacefulness and forgiveness. People act that way. They are provocative. They say stupid things, foolish things. It's not, it's like the way we work with children. You don't have to condone behavior. You can try to correct it. But that doesn't mean that you still don't love the child. It's the same thing with each other. I might not like the way you're behaving. And so perhaps I have an opportunity to kindly correct or suggest or not respond. The not responding, it turns out, takes the most self-control. Because sometimes, they say that there are four things that you have to keep in mind before you speak. The first is it true to the best of you? The second of all is, would it be helpful? And then the third and fourth are, is it the right time to speak? And is it the right place to speak? I don't tend to have too much difficulty with number one. And number two, I'm much better at it. The right time and place sometimes fits me. Because someone does or says something that is really out of line, really egregious. And I want to right away respond. But sometimes that is not the best thing. Sometimes it is. But you have to really know yourself so well before that becomes easy. That is the why we sit. We sit in Zazen to get to know this one here so intimately and authentically. Because life is one surprise after another. And just when you think everything is just going sportingly well, someone says or does something that says, what? In that moment, I advise you. Make a deep breath. Don't say anything immediately. Even though that nasty little comment is right on the tip of your tongue, hold on to it for a few extra seconds. And see if perhaps you can settle yourself down here. Because 9 times out of 10, whatever was going to come out of your mouth, A, is not going to be helpful, and B, is probably not the right time. If we give ourselves even a minute, sometimes that's enough. Sometimes you have to wait a whole day. I mean, how many of you have written the email response? You total jerk. How could you have said this to me? Well, blah, blah, blah. Don't send it. Wait 24 hours. Nothing's going to happen in 24 hours. And then reread it. And soften it. And soften it. Don't change the message. Just change the tone. That is a gift. You have it in your power to give. It is all going to be taken away. Physically, mentally, emotional, all of these things that we take for granted are going to be taken away. And so, what can we rely on, do you think? How are we going to practice with this tremendous loss that you're telling me about? What a bummer. We cannot rely on anything. We cannot rely on anyone. In fact, quite honestly, we really can't even rely on anything. What you can rely on is your own self-knowledge that is only brought about by the long years of sitting in the prison. It is the greatest gift, first of all, that you can give yourself. It is not a blissful experience. I will just tell you that up front. You know, maybe the first 6 months you're thinking, wow, this is great stuff. And I did. But then what ends up happening is, you know, the Pandora's box is open. And if you know that story, you can't get it closed again. Once you've seen it, you can't unsee it. But it is really better to see yourself as you truly are than to pretend that you're somebody else. To be absolutely sure who you are and where you need to work. What a gift. The majority of people live as though they're in a baseball game where the pitcher is throwing the ball at 90 miles an hour. And all they have to do is close their eyes and pretend that it's not happening. The baseball is still going to hit you, whether you've got your eyes closed or not. If you keep your eyes open, suddenly you have a lot of choices. Oh, I could duck. I could catch it. There's lots of things that you can do with your eyes wide open with self-knowledge. So first of all, you give this gift to yourself. Because what that shows you, by the way, is that you are enough as you are. We all have room for self-improvement, but we are all unique, wonderful, amazing, with something to offer the world. The world would like to tell you are not enough, and that is because the world wants to sell you things that will make you feel like you are enough. You are already enough, just as you are, and that doesn't mean you don't keep going deeper and deeper. Because once you give this gift to yourself, then you have an opportunity to spread the gift around. Everywhere you go, you take this gift with you. It is the gift of self-knowledge, of kindness, of generosity, of forgiveness. But just gift you can. So whatever it was that you came here for today, that is what I hope you take with you. Do not think that this is just something you dropped in to see what's what. Take it home. Practice. Every day, even if it's only 10 minutes. If everyone in the world sat zazen for 10 minutes a day, we would not be in the mess that we are in right now. You don't even have to tell your friends you're doing it. It's amazing. My husband has never been as impacted as him, but he is a young student through our office. He can't help but be. He can't kill spiders anymore because of him. He never thought twice about killing a spider when we were first together. Thanks. You can do it. Just by one thing. Thank you. well over the phone.
You never take that, but he's going to hear it in the back of my head.
So we have 1 minute. If you have a question or a comment or something you'd like to add, please.
I just like to reflect that it was 4 years ago today that you stepped down, and that, the impact it's had.
Huge. And a lot of good stuff. Thank you. If you are feeling sad, it's yours. Because we have an opportunity to make a move. COVID caught us in these house jobs. We weren't ready for this. We're ready for this. We know better how to take care of each other, but we also learned that we need to take care.
Oh, yes.
In Christianity, I think
Can you speak a little louder?
in Christianity, they have, I think Corinthians, they talk about the fruits of the Spirit. And a lot of the things they're saying about how we should be are fruits of the Spirit. But I'm wondering how you distinguish like an egoic trying to be kind or trying to, or versus like a fruit, more of something that's more spontaneous.
You notice I didn't actually say kind.
I mean, I didn't.
No, we are not kind. It naturally flows. It is the fruit of our activity. We sit down with no expectation, but the amazing thing is what actually happens. And you're right, it is just that. We become more generous. I always go back to the Greeks because they learned from the Buddhists. They invaded Gandhara and they really liked the Buddhist ideal, and so they brought it back. And guess what? The Greek philosophers, know thyself, do no harm. That's Buddhism too, in a nutshell. And but to know thyself automatically means you don't want to harm. Right? The more you know yourself, the less you want to do that. And so you're absolutely right. It's not that we are trying to be kind. It's not that we are trying to be generous. It will naturally flow from your practice. And that is always a big surprise to me. But thank you for pointing that out.
About being kind, what if others treat our kindness as a witness?
They will, because they are fearful. When other people accuse you of being weak, it is because they are worried that I'm not strong. So we have to learn not to worry about what they think. It's more important what you think about yourself. When with certain people, your kindness will never make any difference and will respond to it. With other people, you will change their minds. So you weigh those two things.
That's good enough.
But yes, and you continue being kind. Don't let other people, same thing is true for me all those years ago, and you should be such a nice person. I wasn't kind to demons. I was kind, not kind. It was merely a matter of blessing my life. Go and keep doing that.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.